This is Geek Speak, episode 29 of season 16. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Brian Young. He's an iOS developer, designer, and...
And I never finished that, did I?
You didn't finish that. What's going on? I was going to say conference developer.
I should say conference goer right now. Yeah, yeah.
That's the thing is, that's why you're in Vegas right now.
Yes.
What conference are you going to?
I'm going to a FileMaker conference.
A FileMaker conference, as in FileMaker Pro, the awesome database rapid development software thing. Have you ever done a database in that thing?
No. I've not used it until very recently.
Learning.
Really learning some things.
What do you think?
Well, it's interesting. Apple's doing this whole push to do business apps to get more into the business world in both iOS and Mac. And so I'm taking a look at what FileMaker offers.
And you actually work for 4D, which also is a similar kind of business application suite. Similar to FileMaker.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. They used to be more direct competitors. 4D's market's a little bit... different these days.
Yeah.
But they're similar environments.
Yeah. And so this environment of business application, what defines a business application? Not Twitter, right?
Yeah, not Twitter. No, not consumer facing. No, something that runs a business, something that's helping a business just automate the normal processes and put the business on the path of getting things done efficiently.
Right. So anytime you see like accounting software, be business software, kind of point of sale type software, dentist office management software, all that kind of stuff.
There's great acronym soup we can go into.
No,
ERP, CRM.
We will not go into that. Oh my God. Do you know the names of all those things?
Unfortunately, yes.
So anyway, you're over at the Cosmopolitan.
Yes.
Cosmopolitan
Happens
Hotel.
Happens to be neighboring the
Bellagio, which is where I am. And I'm also traveling for work, and I'm at at Netflix, we do qualitative analysis. What that means is that we pay people to give us feedback on our products. And so we'll go to different cities, and I focus on interactive kids content. And so we're going to be talking with 8 parents and their children tomorrow and having them look at the thing I've been building. And it's actually now live on the service and totally available for everyone to play with. If you've got an iPad, you can see what I do for a living. If you have Netflix and iPad, you can go search for a show called Word Party. And assuming you're in the right cell, because we do test cells, you'll see an interactive experience as you're watching the show. And I think it's actually a really cool show because it's done with Jim Henson Studios. And it's all motion capture and puppeteering, all digital. It's kind of cool. Anyway, we're going to have kids look at it tomorrow. And then while they look at it, we're going to ask them questions. And that's why I'm in Vegas.
So you're saying the kids can watch this show and you don't have to do this long pause of, hey, kids, say A.
That's right.
And you have to time it so that they actually react at the right time.
I talk about this kind of stuff so much with friends in a geeky way that last week I might have talked about this with Miles on the podcast, but I don't recall. So now I feel like I might be repeating myself. The show teaches little kids, 18 months and older, vocabulary words. So the first episode, you learn the panda and you learn... wallaby and elephant and cheetah, and cheetahs are fast runners. You've done animation before, so you know that when you're working on animation, even if it's coding animation, you actually have to run the sequence multiple times. So for the last long time, I've been running the show, and I know all the voices of the characters, and I know the lines they say. Elephants are good swimmers. And I'm...
Oh, you got that one down good.
It's enough. I listened to it enough. But recently, I switched to French. I think I did say this last week, so I'm sorry, everybody, if I'm repeating myself. But it all in French is just... Oh, magnifique. speaking of French, and not nearly in as happy a tone, I should have to say. France, actually, the government released an app that is supposed to notify people of terror attacks. And the idea is you put this app on your phone and kind of emergency response system in the States where you can get an alert. Have you ever gotten one of those for a child?
Amber alerts here in California. Yeah, all the time.
So you can, most smartphones, you can turn this on and maybe it comes on by default and your phone will go bloop, 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 and kind of alert. Much more, it used to be on radio and television broadcasts, but since our phones are always with us, it's kind of a cool feature.
Are Amber alerts national? I can't recall.
I don't know. I'm a California guy, so I don't know if they're national.
Yeah.
I'm sure somebody will chime in. Since we're in Nevada, we should probably know that right now. any case, in France, they came up with this app that the government sponsored that would basically alert people. And you could do all these great things. You give it, geolocation, and you could be told that there's an attack on trees, get out of this area. All those things you could think of to do to help people in a terrorist attack. This is what this app was supposed to do. Unfortunately, it took nearly 3 hours for this terror alert app to talk at all about the Nice attack. So it was a complete fail from a systems situation. And the thing is that when you provide a safety service of this feature, this kind of service, when you fail miserably at it, it's worse than not providing it in the first place. Because, you know, you can kind of rely upon technology helping you. And if you do that, normally you'd think, when you rely upon it and it doesn't, and it fails to do so, it's worse than not relying on it at all. Anyway, it's kind of a bummer that failed.
Well, the incident took place in a very short period of time, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it was, so according to the ministry, the app would provide users with alerts and information within 15 minutes of the terrorist attack. But it apparently took 3 hours in the other night's Nice attack for anything to happen. The system is called the SAIP, or the Système d'Alerte et d'Information des Populations.
Oh, and you're brave.
Mutilated that French, huh? And I don't even speak French. Okay, so in any case, a fail there. Hopefully they'll fix it. And of course, the way you can kind of do this, if you look at Twitter all the time, you can know when things are changing. And I'll have another story in just a second about Twitter and knowing about systems being online or offline. A little bit later, though, when we talk about gaming. But first, let's talk about people being stupid with automated vehicles.
Oh, no. Yes. Okay, so it's been a couple weeks since this story, but most people probably know by now about the gentleman. Let me see if I can pull up the correct story. I've got like 10 of them here about this.
First off, let me just congratulate you for doing your navigation of your computer with one hand, because I did not bring mic stands with us to Vegas. So we're both holding microphones and we're being very careful to do so, but we're one-handed typists this evening.
So I keep all my notes here in Evernote, mm-hmm. and I'm skipping back and forth between articles left and right here trying to find the right one. But yes, there was a gentleman who made the news as a Tesla enthusiast who was relying on his the autopilot feature of his Tesla car. The details, I still don't think we know the details of exactly what he was doing. But
we do know that he was killed.
Yeah, the one thing we know is that he, while driving on a freeway, not a full freeway, he was driving and there was a large white semi-truck that had crossed the road. And because of the glaring white, glaring bright paint and the sun, the way it was situated, neither the driver nor the car was aware that the truck was crossing the road. And so the Tesla went right under the trailer of the truck. And that was the end of the driver.
And to keep in mind, we actually don't know if the driver was paying attention. He might have been doing other things.
No, but this is not what I want to talk about.
Okay.
This is a very sad story, and this Tesla driver was an enthusiast, and he definitely was trying out all the different features of his car. But what I didn't know is what all those features were and what all the different stages of semi-autonomous cars are.
This is the beta program for Tesla vehicles that have slightly more than cruise control and even more than like lane drift control. But actually, what other things they do? I don't even know.
So there's a great write-up by another Tesla enthusiast, somebody we listen to as well.
Marco Arment?
Yes. Mm. He has recently bought one of these, and he has a great little write-up on what these different features are. And it's confusing to anybody who just thinks about these as semi-autonomous cars, because they're each individual features. There's automatic emergency braking. If you were to be driving and something jumped out in front of you quickly, it would automatically brake the car. There's auto park. Now this one gets into the real view of what an autonomous car should be, where it actually, this one's been around for a long time on other cars. This reverses you into parking spots, that otherwise might be a little bit tricky. Many cars have something like
effectively that. Effectively what you do is you draw, it kind of gives you some guidance and you drive up to it. And then at one point you can push a button and it kind of scans location and then it puts it back in, it puts the vehicle in there. That's right. Not the, it drives without you. You kind of help it along.
No, but it does have that for parking in a garage and returning from the garage.
Which is not supposed to be done in public areas. It's only supposed to be in private areas, but.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that's called the summon feature. And that really gets into science fiction kind of automation. They have also adaptive cruise control, which we all know what cruise control is. Mm-hmm. It maintains a speed. Well, this one maintains a speed on the freeway with actual awareness of objects in front of you. So,
because lots of times when you're doing cruise control, you're driving a certain speed and then someone slowly slows down in front of you and you got to put your brake on. And then, of course, that just detaches cruise control. So then you have to reset it or re-enable it and then it's the wrong speed. This is basically effectively doing all that stuff for you.
Exactly. Yeah, and cool. By all accounts, this is the real big win. Right now, in cars that have this, which include Tesla and BMW and a few others, it's a marvel because you can sit there in stop and go traffic and it takes over the accelerator for you.
But I have to say that there's a boundary there because if it does too much and you start getting complacent, that's when a problem can emerge.
Well, that's when we get into what is called auto steer, and this is what everybody calls autopilot. Sort of a misnomer.
The one that keeps you in the lane.
Yes. So once you've got adaptive cruise control on and then you turn on auto steer, you can actually take your hands off the wheel and the car will continue to drive itself for a short period of time. And this is where...
And after a while, it notices you're not on the wheel and it says something, right? It alerts you.
Yeah.
That's what you mean by a short period of time.
Short period of time. I'm trying to look up what the timing on that is. It's... I believe it's over a minute. There are some other cars out there that have a feature like this, but have much shorter time periods. I believe Volvo has one coming out that's going to be able to do this. But this is really interesting because this is what the driver most likely got himself in trouble with by relying on this feature. Now, once you've got the car able to steer itself and control the accelerator, all of a sudden you don't have any direct input in the car or any need to give direct input to the car.
Your brain can
at
shut
all
down.
Times. Yeah, yeah. You can actually start to look around at other things. And there's possibly great safety things here. You could see problems in traffic you wouldn't be able to be aware of otherwise.
Well, that's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe there's a car being really unsafe a couple lanes over from you and you can be aware of that. But
Most of the time, you're just going to go down and look at your phone. And
yeah, yeah. This is where it just
starts
to, you can easily get distracted and no longer be the primary driver of the car. And it's just kind of weird that this is a, we called it a beta technology. They warn the driver in many ways when they turn this on. You have to turn this on. It's not on by default.
And the reason why this is extremely dangerous, of course, is there's not a fully 3D scanning LiDAR situation where it completely maps your system and lots of software developed and making sure that nothing is going to happen bad,
right,
like the really autonomous vehicles are doing.
Right.
This is much more like it has a sensor in the front, has some sensors on the side, and it can kind of maintain a speed. Like that's what it does.
And one of its primary sensors is a camera.
It's doing this. But if somebody, a cardboard box drops out of the back of someone's car, the vehicle's not going to do anything about it. It's just going to hit it. Like which might actually be the best thing to do, but but I'm saying that it's not really driving for you, and you have to be aware that it's not driving for you.
I think in that situation, it actually would try to avoid the object.
I think it would just stop. I don't know if it would avoid, because of course, avoidance means you have to have a lot of awareness of the location, because you can avoid into into a tree. That's not a good avoidance.
Well, I've seen videos of this system where if a car comes into your lane, veers over into your lane too close,
slows down.
Well, no, the car reacts and swerves to the side to avoid being hit.
It's not a good thing necessarily, because if it's not really driving and it swerves, then it doesn't know what's happening 15 paces ahead of
no,
15
no,
vehicles
doesn't.
Ahead, right? And so maybe the lane stopped over there. And you've known that for a long time. And coming along and someone's going, oh, I better get out of this lane. All of a sudden, you swerve in the same lane that the car just left. This is the problem, right?
This is the problem. And the way I like to think about this, I come from computer graphics. And computer graphics technology and motion capture has this concept of the uncanny valley.
Yes.
When you make something look close to real, but not real enough, it just weirds people out. And it's very difficult. You have to put a lot of effort in to go from something that's not supposed to look real to something that really does look real. It's a small step as far as
percentage of reality.
Yeah, percentage of reality. But actually getting there is a lot of effort. And the car industry is now at that point where they have gotten so many automated features in their cars that it can do a lot for you. But this feature, this ability to tune out and not be fully aware of what your car is doing or what's in front of you, I think that hits that point where I don't know if this feature should be on in any car, because I think we need to go much further than this to bridge that gap, to jump all the way to full autonomy before it becomes truly useful.
The autonomous valley.
Where the autonomous valley. I like that.
Yeah.
And then you have Evel Knievel has to jump the autonomous valley.
Exactly. Very cool.
And
any other stories of vehicles?
Well, yeah, I actually have a bunch of articles that are all related here. So there's also an article describing the different levels of what makes up a autonomous car. Because, you know, everybody's thinking about this, so they've got to name them. We've covered
this before. They've got like five different levels.
Oh, we did. Did we cover this
before? Somebody did. Not necessarily you.
Well, this is a good time to just review them really quick. Because level zero is what we all got. Just a regular car and a human driver. But you can go up to level one where it's capable of some basic automatic functions like braking. And
would level one be like skid control, like, you know, computer assisted braking that we all kind of have?
Well, that's still the human making the decision. So that's level zero.
Oh, okay. But, well, you know, when the vehicle actually stutters the brake so the tire doesn't spin, that is assisted braking. Like there's intelligence involved in that, if you will. Meaning, if I slam my brakes on with a vehicle that what's it called?
What, ABS brakes?
Yeah. What's ABS stand for?
There's no intelligence in that. That's just a way of keeping the friction from being lost.
Why do you
lost.
Say there's no intelligence on that?
Oh, I'm sure you can have a computer-controlled one. Anti-lock brakes. But you could also have a completely mechanical system. I'm sure the computer one works a little bit better. But no, the driver is the one that's telling the car to stop.
Okay.
Even though the technology is assisting in making it work better.
All right. So
number one is the vehicle's capable of some automatic functions like braking. So that's what we were talking about. Stop and go driving. It'll brake for you. Level two, the vehicle's capable of automating at least two functions like cruise control and centering into the lane at the same time. And level three, safety functions can be shifted to automation under certain conditions, like maybe the weather and traffic conditions require that the human driver. Under some conditions like bad weather and bad traffic conditions, it has to go back to the human driver. But other than that, it does have autonomous control of the car. And then level four is the vehicle is finally capable of all functions for the entire trip. Fully autonomous. Going from San Francisco to Seattle.
Wait, that's level four?
That's level four. There is a fifth level, which this gets
there's six levels.
Debatable. No, there's...
It was level zero is what you started with. Oh, I see. No, that's not really... Okay.
You got me on the...
Level five, host fully autonomous. What does this do?
Zero is no autonomy, so I win.
I think you're totally right. I concede.
This one gets debatable. Some people don't even recognize it. But fully autonomous vehicle that does not even offer a steering wheel or controls.
Oh, you can't.
So that would be the Google car.
What they wanted to do.
The original Google car idea.
Or iRobot. They had cars like that. But could take it over.
But think about it. If there's this autonomous valley that we have to cross, wouldn't it be better to go all the way to the point where the car has full control?
Yeah, probably. Because people are going to do stupid things if they get involved.
Yeah. In fact, I think the hardest part about automated cars is actually the human factor. I think that people are getting in the way. In fact, there's another... study that somebody did, because, you know, people are trying to figure out the ethics of automated cars. How does the car decide what to do in a tricky situation like pedestrians and the car having to decide if it can't brake, should it go and hit the pedestrians or should it put the driver in danger? And this was a wonderful little study because it gets into the human problem, mm-hmm. which says, you know,
that's a moral question.
It's a moral question, but when you ask people that, what kind of car would you go out and buy? Would you buy one that is going to decide to save the 10 pedestrians or
you.
The driver? Which one?
Do you want to buy?
Well,
more importantly, which one do you want to buy for your 16-year-old child?
So let me back up. If you ask that dilemma of a person, do you want to save the 10 pedestrians or do you want to save the driver? They'll say, well, you save the 10 pedestrians. And then you ask the question, if you want to go out and buy a car, which one would you buy? Would you buy the one that at all costs will save the driver or the one that would save the pedestrians? People are going to choose the one that saves the driver. So once again,
automated cars. What they turn into is those people become less people and become more of a potentiality, and then their death is a potentiality, right?
Right, because people are selfish.
Yeah. By the way, your idea of the uncanny automation and like skipping that point, because that's where our human brain has the problems. There's a terminology for that in tech support, and that is PEBCAC. Have you ever heard that term? PEBCAC.
No.
It's a malfunction of a computer, kind of.
PEBCAC.
It stands for problem exists between keyboard and chair. That's a PEBCAC. I'm sure a lot of our listeners know and have called people that. Because what you can do, of course, is go, oh, yeah, no. The problem down here was totally a PEBCAC. I've solved it, right?
And nobody will know the wiser.
Hey, I cannot believe we need laws for this. Okay, we're done with cars?
Yes, we're done with cars.
That's the summation of... The summation, not laws, but rules for this. The summation of the headline of this. So Starbucks and McDonald's, and of course, McDonald's is the hamburger of coffee, of Starbucks coffee, and Starbucks is the coffee of McDonald's hamburger.
You don't have a high opinion of Starbucks, do you?
I don't. But, you know, that's just because I'm snobby. So don't listen to me. I have my own espresso machine at work. Anyway, so anti-pornography groups have succeeded in their efforts to get Starbucks and McDonald's to block porn on their Wi-Fi networks.
Way to go.
Congratulations. The thing that's great about this is that, no, they've got them to accept the responsibility of blocking pornography on their networks. They're not going to do it because it's not possible to really block content. Like, you can't block content and still make the network work.
So what's going on here?
I don't know what they're
going to do. McDonald's just simply said, yes, we will block it.
Well, so earlier this year, McDonald's responded by putting filters in place at most of its U.S. restaurants, right? And that, of course, they disclosed that this week. So they did it a while ago. And the company had already had filters in U.K. restaurants already, probably because U.K. laws about public spaces. So they had laws and therefore they had filters. So turning them on in the U.S. was just about changing... maybe there's different terminology for pornography in the UK, you know, British English. They talk about lorries and stuff. Anyway, McDonald's, here's a quote. McDonald's is committed to providing a safe environment for our customers. We had not heard from our customers that this was an issue, but we saw an opportunity that is consistent with our goal of providing an enjoyable experience for families. So if they're a family restaurant, definitely something you probably want to handle. I got to say that the reason why I think it's odd that we have to have rules about this is that clearly people were doing this at Starbucks and McDonald's looking at pornography. Really? I mean, come on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what's the difference? Did they have Playboys over in the booth as well?
So the reason I bring this up on GeekSpeak is not because they're doing this. That's fine. The thing is, the general population doesn't understand that it's not actually possible to block content. You could make it difficult. But you can't block it. My friend's works for a school in Hayward, and he's a teacher, and he was telling me about some students, and he runs a computer lab sometimes, and he kind of figured out that there were some kids looking at pornography in the back of the room, and so he did that because he's got screen sharing on, but they had actually hidden the screen sharing feature, but he kind of got a feel that it was happening, and so he just. He just lied to them. He just goes, hey, who in this room? Hey, I just got a text message from what's the school? The boss of the school? Or
the principal.
No, not the principal. Outside the principal. The district office. Oh, I just got a text message from district office that somebody here is looking at pornography on station number 12. Or is that you guys? Are you doing that? Why did I get that alert? So they all of a sudden don't think it's him, right? They think it's some bigger body. But I said, so that happens? He's like, oh yeah, there's tons of blocking. Like, the whole network's controlled and safe. There's no way they can do that. And they totally were doing that.
Right.
I don't know how they were doing that. But I figured, so basically you just socially engineered the problem away rather than trying to solve it technically, which is actually much more effective.
Well, these things are a social problem.
Yeah.
If they're a problem at all, it's a social problem. So it's not a technological solution that you can truly bring to bear.
And, you know, if you want to start thinking about, like, how do you determine whether it's content that shouldn't be viewable in a Starbucks or a McDonald's, they're going to have to make some kind of rule, right? And so then you get into that boundary of, like, what's appropriate. Can they look at the Statue of David? Because that's a, you know, raw penis or raw buttocks just sitting there in stone. Or does it have to be more graphic? But somebody's got to have a rule and someone has to assess. And unfortunately, that assessing and rule calculation is going to be a human being when it comes down to it. So the only way to really do this is set up some kind of fine situation so that if the person does it wrong and then other people think it's wrong, you just can't achieve it. It's not a technical problem. It's a social problem, as you just said. Have we covered that enough? I think we have.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's covered plenty.
Well, you had two stories about autonomous vehicles and stuff. And so we can move on to what I want to talk about. Do you mind if we talk about Pokemon?
Yeah, let's talk about the game I still haven't been able to open. Okay, so
why haven't you done it?
Well, no, I tried. You told me about it the first day we were talking about it. Like, I got to open it up, and I just couldn't get the thing to work because it was overloaded. And then I had to go back and turn off my Google permissions for Pokemon because everybody said, oh, wait a second, they've got too much permissions.
That's right. As I was editing the show from last week where we're warning people about that, it's been fixed and addressed and totally updated. So yeah, don't worry about the Google account management. They changed it and they are more clear now. It looks like it's a little confusing to whether there was a problem in the first place, but we won't get into that because that's boring.
Well, there's one thing I wanted to mention about that. It was never quite as scary as everybody was talking about. Apparently the access they're getting is account access. It's, about your profile, not about, they couldn't read your email. They couldn't get into all of
it. So I read that article that you forwarded off to us. And to my mind, it still doesn't clarify it to me because their article was not exactly clear.
No,
it is possible.
Wasn't.
It is possible that normally full access means full access. Like that's what your Chrome browser gives access to. But it is possible that all that means is you have an authority to start asking. But in any case,
okay.
Too much detail. Like they definitely addressed the problem now.
Yeah.
And they've done a few updates to Pokemon. Of course, Pokemon Go, you know what that is. I don't have to get into it. So we were, as a family, my wife was like, hey, why don't we play that? Because I was talking about it. I was like, kind of random. It's kind of fun. You walk around, you have to travel, and there's lots of people playing it all over the place in parks and cities. And everywhere you go right now, if you see people with phones and they're walking, looking at their phones, and especially if they're in groups, they're playing Pokemon Go. And if you start looking for it, you'll see it a lot. Well, anyway, this week, so we decided that on Sunday, we take the family day, we go down to Santa Cruz downtown, have some food somewhere, went to Zachary's, it was really good, and kind of walk around and collect Pokemon as a family. So I turn on my tethering on my plan so the kids can connect with their non-cell service devices, you know, iPods and stuff, and we start working. We did it like a block, and then we went to eat. And then afterwards, we couldn't get it to work for any of us. So my son goes on to Twitter, and he starts reading. And sure enough, it's all covered on Twitter. People have found out that the servers went down, and the reason they went down is because of Canada. Actually, it seriously is because of Canada. They turned on Canada on Sunday or that weekend, and then the load spiked, and they couldn't handle the load. So the service was down for a while. So I blame Greg Merkley, our Canadian correspondent, for that. Anyway, that evening, we went back out again. It was working. And the thing that was so cool is we took the dog to a dog park, and then we all walked together talking and looking at our phones and exploring places we hadn't gone before as a family, the dog happily joining along with us. And we were probably walking around, you know, Scotts Valley, the towns where we went to, maybe for an hour, just enjoying the summer night, Eve. It was great.
Out in nature, looking at your phones?
Looking at our phones, looking at virtual nature in nature. Yeah.
So when one person gets the Pokemon, does that mean the other person can't get the Pokemon?
That's the great thing about the design of the game. If a Pokemon shows up, everyone gets that Pokemon in the location. And to find them, you have to like look for clues, kind of. So it's a bit of like finding and searching and trying. And then once somebody does it, then everybody does the same thing. It's very collaborative if you do it as a group. It's cool.
So what level are you now?
I'm level 7.
You're level 7?
Oh my God, Vegas. If I didn't have like Geek Speak to do, I could be collecting Pokemon. Like it. But now that I've done it with my family, I don't want to do it alone. Like it's a lot more fun with other people. So Vegas is full of these. There's these like places that are kind of marked that you can go and collect things from. And then there's other places that are battlefields that you can go to called training rooms.
So there's gyms, there's
Pokemon spots, I think
spots.
I'm not sure if they're called
and
spots.
And then there's the lures. Have you run into the lures?
So a Pokemon spot, like a base or a station Pokemon thing, you can add a lure to it. And then it becomes, collects them. And yeah, there's a lot going on here. And the thing that's really interesting about these, like when we were in Scotts Valley, we traveled across the town because there was a Pokemon lure, and that Pokemon lure that was going along, that basically means there's more Pokemon at that spot, was at an ice cream joint. And I'm like, oh my God, if I owned an ice cream joint, I would make sure that lure was always running. It cost a dollar to run it for 30 minutes, right? Because people show up and then of course they'll get ice cream.
So I saw that people are looking in the code of Pokemon and they think there might be a deal with McDonald's going on.
Oh, because there's lots of them.
So maybe McDonald's had to block the porn so that they have more bandwidth for Pokemon.
So the thing that's, and we'll talk in the post a little bit more about a bug that exists in the software that I've run into at work too, but this is just the start of this. The reason why I'm excited about this is that I've been engaged in augmented reality for a while. At UCSC, I was engaged. I talked a bit about that last week. And so I've thought about the potential for quite a while. And of course, having Google Glass, knowing the augmented reality, the features that that provided, having more rich data about the world is kind of cool. And Pokemon being so successful means this whole world is just going to explode in investment. There's going to be a lot more games of this sort. Collection games, or you can imagine that Pokemon will probably be the platform that this exists in for a while, but they could start adding coupons, so you can see a coupon at a store, and that's an advertisement for the store, and of course the store is paying them. There's going to be a lot of that kind of engagement with this game. It's going to be probably a very large new platform.
No, absolutely. But if somebody tries to be a competitor, that's going to be hard. They've built up this data for years of trying to figure out where you could put something in the game, which yeah. is not private land, is not out where somebody's going to get hurt trying to get to it, all that kind of thing.
There is a lot of that. At the same time, if you did launch an app and the app was also on the phone that a person that was using a Pokemon account, you potentially, I mean, if enough people install your app that has geolocation, you know where people go. And if you know where people go at different times at the same location, you kind of know they're not relatives. They're going to public space, right? So there's ways of detecting that. But you're right, that the barrier to entry into this kind of system is expensive. But because of the success of Pokemon Go, people will cause that. We'll pay that expense. Like there will be explosion in augmented reality. And that's just kind of neat. And the other thing is that, you know, as all these things go, people will get upset about this game at some point. It'll be to this or that, or it'll be, you know, the whole, oh, it used to be great, now it's lame. That's going to kick in at some point. And when that happens, there'll be other game, you know, other capabilities in that space that other people can step into. So if you're an app developer like you and me, oh, this is horrible. It's the time to jump into AR. It's why not? It'll be fun. Should we do that?
We should put the mics down right now. Although
I've
been waiting to hear about this one company that came out of what's the company that does Steam? Valve.
Sure.
Yeah, there's a AR tabletop game that I was hoping to see. My whole childhood of tabletop games and role playing was I've been waiting for it to become in the digital future. And imagine having glasses where if you're wearing the AR glasses, you can see the tabletop game out there in front of you, and it'll animate and it'll, you know, adjust to the rules. I can't wait for that stuff.
Why? What about imagination?
No, but this is like making your imagination real and then interacting with it. It's fantasy, only you see it. It'd be fun.
I mean, that sounds a lot like the HoloLens. I mean, that's Microsoft's AR solution, the HoloLens, but it's different. This
predates the HoloLens, but I don't know that it's been actually released as a product yet. I keep looking out for it.
For some reason, you taking AR into tabletop just upsets me.
Why?
Because I'm a gamer, man. I've been playing D&D since I was a kid. Still, I'm in a campaign that I've been playing for over 20 years.
So here's
and
the thing.
I don't want that to change. I like the pencil and the sharpener, you know? I like the dice. I don't want that to change. I'm not playing that anymore, but I don't want it to change.
So this is funny. So my wife and I are chuckling because our daughter has just decided to get way into D&D.
Because she's awesome.
Yeah, because she's awesome. We feel like, okay, our job here as parents is done. But I remember when we were kids.
You know, the pain just starts, right? She's going to get in middle school in a few years, and she's going to be D&D nerd, and oh, man.
Well, this is where she starts ignoring us, right?
Yeah.
No, Mom, I'm trying to roll my character. No, but I remember as a kid, D&D was this scary thing that was all new, and parents were scared of it and all of that. Well, the new thing now, of course, we've got augmented reality, virtual reality, that we're on the cusp of being much bigger.
I think the thing the parents are upset about is that the YouTube channels have comment videos. Like, oh, that's what I'm suffering with my children. But anyway, go on. Yes.
Oh, now you derailed me.
Well you were going to say that the thing we're going to be scared about is AR. But, exactly. Take away my dice. What are you ruining the game?
But okay, when you're sitting there playing D&D, I never got the mechanics well. I always relied on my other friends. They understood the mechanics. They could look up in the player's manual and the DM's guide, find all the right charts, and that stuff.
Wait,
was so...
you're a programmer. I'm totally assuming that that's one of the things you'd be strong at. What?
No, that procedural stuff was just, it was getting in the way of the game. I wanted to be there imaginatively playing. I wanted to go through the adventure.
You wanted to, wait. Did you go to Ren Faire a lot?
Yes, I did.
Aha! That's the type you are.
I was one
are.
Of those gamers.
So wanted to speak in an accent when you were gaming. Is that
so the promise of this kind of computer games, instead of just looking at a screen, you take the screen and it turns into the tabletop, and all of a sudden you've got something interactive, and you're not worrying about the gameplay, you're worrying about the strategy and the
role
play.
Yeah, but
Brian,
when you do that, you destroy the whole beauty of painting your own lead figure. Like
okay,
really
that,
taking
that is beauty.
Some time.
That is beauty.
Right? And then if you say, well, let's virtualize the table. Oh, look, I can animate my guy. I'm like, no, I spent 6 hours painting his face. Isn't the eye almost straight?
But now you can put your AR glasses on or your VR glasses, and you can paint in 3D space. And then you're going to have your lead figure, and you're going to paint
your
lead figure.
Hey, man, as long as kids are being creative. So we're going to do a D&D campaign for the kids, is what you're saying.
We're going to have to. We're going to figure out a way. Can we clone ourselves?
I just wish I just had my 16-year-old self, because that would work, right? But right now, I don't know if I could run a D&D campaign. Though they're fun. They are a lot of fun. You know, as the whole family getting together, we could do that. Like once a month, do an evening where we'd play D&D.
Yeah, I think that's the way it's going to have to work. Somebody has to be a DM, and they have to put the work in between.
So
there.
Maybe we don't do an episode every week of D&D.
Sorry, the Geek Speak episodes have...
No, we'll keep doing it. You've got a kind of... Well, first off... No, let's go ahead and dive right into this. It'll be fun. Okay, so you've got this really cool story about voice command systems. We talked a lot about a couple weeks, maybe it was last week, a couple weeks ago, we talked a lot about Siri and my new favorite one, Amazon Echo, or what is her name?
Alexa.
Alexa. Very cool systems that allow you to do voice commands. You want to take it from here?
Yeah. So this is billed as a hack, as a dangerous next generation, we're going to hack into your phone. But I thought this story is really cool because I didn't think about this. But some researchers were trying to find a way to make audio that you couldn't understand. You and I would hear it sound garbled. You couldn't make heads or tails of it. But that could actually control your phone.
That could run Siri or
Google Now,
whatever. Yeah.
You're doing voice commands to Siri and Google Now, and so, assuming Alexa, although Alexa maybe not. She's got quite an array of...
But all these would have to be tuned based off of what the system... So what you're saying is they'd make audio that we couldn't understand, but the algorithms that did remove noise would make the system be able to understand. Do you have a recording of one of these?
Yeah.
Okay, throw it on your microphone. Just put your microphone down on your computer. Just play it.
Okay, let's try to make this work.
I heard destiny.com.
Yeah, so it's barely audible.
Do it one more time. Yeah, it's hard to hear some of it. Destiny.com, you got it. But the beginning of that, I think it was go to URL.
Yeah, must have been go to URL. Yeah, yeah. So the whole idea is there's all this audio processing that has to happen for the phone to understand and make a signal that it can turn into text, which is how these systems work in the base. But that, you can think of this. One person I was listening to put it this way. Our brains do all that audio processing as well. And when you hear somebody talk, what you're hearing is after our brains have all cleaned that up and made it legible to us audible to us.
Sure. And that's why you can actually hear a sound, not know what it was. And if somebody else says what it is, that helps your brain to hear it. And then you can't not hear it that way.
Right, because we're the best pattern matching systems out there. So well, this imagine this. This would be like listening to the sound without your brain processing the audio. This is like the raw sound to your ears. Mm-hmm. That's one way to think about it.
Right, right.
So, but of course, the Siri and Google Now are able to listen to that and find the signal from the noise and produce a result. Anyways,
it's so, a bummer that they take this and couch it under hacking, safety, a lot of fear-based stuff.
Yeah, I've been trying to figure out what you could do with this that would actually be a security hazard to your phone. I'm sure on Android you can set up voice commands that are more dangerous possibly than what iOS is locked down to.
See, my first way of thinking of it is to use it as in a hack methodology for art piece, because I did art installation stuff for so long. So that's my first thought, is that you could have a button on your house. When you push it, your phone all of a sudden goes to a website, right? You push a little button and it goes, and your phone actually changes. It's like QR codes everywhere, you know, kind of
cool. Audio QR codes.
Only if your phone actually has that feature enabled. Most people don't have their phones enabled with the Google Now.
Don't say it.
You've been saying it multiple times, dude.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no. We need to gobble it the other way. Google, what is it?
Now Google.
Yeah. Hey, there's been some Airbnb huffy puff, whatever. People are talking about Airbnb, mostly, you know, specifically this whole idea of being able to rent out your apartment or your house or a room in your house to other people. This potentially has the capability of disrupting markets, right?
Like sure.
Hotel markets and stuff.
Yeah, it's the whole sharing economy.
Yeah. So Santa Monica, a while ago, actually, this time last year in 2015, passed some laws, the toughest regulations in this, about short-term rentals. And the rules basically said you cannot rent your a house, fully a dwelling, for less than a month. That's not legal.
Okay, so nowhere in Santa Monica can you just rent it for less than a month.
Right, and that was the law. And they did this for Airbnb purposes. And the argument they have for this is to keep rents low. I don't know how this keeps rents low. I don't understand that exactly. But I guess it means, like, first off, they didn't stop people from renting a bedroom out for the weekend or whatever, because you live there too. It only affects the people that are renting the entire place out. So someone's prosecuted. And Scott Shafford was the first person to be prosecuted for this law. He basically ignored them and kept on renting his places out. And they finally find him. In fact, they did a sting operation where they rented one of his places on Airbnb for $1,200 for 4 nights or 3 nights, like that. They had to pay him because they actually rented it. But with that, they found that the document that he gave out to everybody, that if you ever rented an Airbnb, it's very simple. You sign up, you pick a place, you say, hey, can I stay here? And the other people accept it. Unless, of course, they don't accept you for some reason. That's up to them. And I'll get into that in another story in a second. But they accept you, and then you go to their house, and they're going to say, we're going to meet you there, and they meet you there, or they tell you where the key is or tell you where the combination is. And when you get into the house, there's like a little sheet of paper that says, hey, you know, please feel free to use anything, but the peanut butter is actually for rat traps. It's not good for eating. And there's tea. We recommend this kind of tea. Like, it's kind
house
of like
rules.
It's a house rules, but it's also sometimes like a welcoming mat. It's kind of cool. Anyway, they got the Santa Monica County Council did the sting operation and got that from him. And they ended up, they kept on fining him, and he was ignoring them. And they finally got the court to agree, and his fine happened, and he was served for $3,600. So we're talking about tons of time on the sting operation, $1,200 going to him from the city, and then he's fined $3,600. And he says, yeah, that doesn't really affect me because I make more than that on one of my units. He's like, 4 units in a month, I make much more than that. He also is moving out of the area. So he took the fine. It was not a big deal. The thing that got me about this, and I don't really understand, is help me out here. What is the actual downside for the city to have this happening? Well, how does it increase rates, for example, their claim?
The mechanism for increasing rates.
I'm kind of putting you on the spot here, I know, because I've been thinking about this today, and I have a theory, but I'm not sure.
I understand why cities have a reason not to do it, because it hurts the hotel economy, and the hotel economy is well regulated. This is the same argument with Uber and Lyft going into existing city that has taxis, and it's a well regulated industry, and all of a sudden you're bringing in this unregulated competitor, and the entrenched competitors are they don't have the same rules that they're playing by, so they can't offer the same service. They can't be as cheap. Now, as far as why it would increase rent, I would imagine people would be able to make more off of their property by renting it in small chunks through Airbnb than they would if they were renting it to an individual for a month.
Yeah, I mean, I can see one side would be like, let's say you can afford $100 a month for your apartment, but it's a two-bedroom apartment, and actually you could probably rent their bedroom. So now you get rent for maybe $200 a month from somebody else. Now you can afford more, right? Now you can spend $300. So from some effect, all of a sudden your place where you wouldn't have been able to rent it at one rate, you can now rent it higher. That makes sense when you're renting out a sub-bedroom. But if you're renting out your entire house, I guess maybe, you know, you and your girlfriend both have their own your own apartments because you don't, you know, you're not ready to move in with Mel, right? So you guys both have your own places. You're in a boat and she's in an actual apartment. And so you're renting it when you, you know, every other weekend you rent the place on Airbnb because you're staying together all the time, but you toggle between the places.
Which is funny.
That would make sense.
Yes, that would make sense. And when I went to Paris and we did an Airbnb for a week, and that's exactly what happened. The lady who lived in this apartment went to go live with her boyfriend for the week and rented it out to us.
Okay, so you see this happening. So I guess there is a possibility of rates being affected, and totally makes sense. I just sometimes it feels like this stuff is about fear-based stuff, but also the civil liberty aspect. Why not be able to rent for shorter than 3 months? For a month. It seems like a pretty weird, draconian thing to do. And if it's only affecting the rental rate, but everybody has the possibility of doing that, why does that matter? You have more density of people staying in the town. Isn't that good for their tourism? Of course, it's not good for the hotels.
It's not good for the hotels. It's also not good for the municipality because they collect a lot of taxes off of the hotels.
But that's the thing is if they want to collect taxes, just collect taxes from Airbnb. They could do that. It'd be easy. They just say, hey, Airbnb, if you rent a place here, you have to pay a city tax of this much. And we just passed this law. I mean, that seems to be a fine solution. I don't get it.
So here in America, we love to tout capitalism and capitalism is great. But at the same time, we try to manage housing for the community so that there is in some way a livable, rentable rate. So maybe it's just running into trying to do those two incompatible things in an area like Santa Monica.
Yeah. Well, anyway, that was kind of interesting. The other story about Airbnb is that Elizabeth Warren, Senator, U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren, on Wednesday called for a regulatory probe into whether short-term rental websites such as Airbnb or Home Away From Home, there's a few of them. What just kind of looking at the business and looking at the impact. And Senator Brian Schultz of Hawaii and Dianne Feinstein of California have joined Warren with this call for a investigation and research into this unregulated space. Quote, "We are concerned that short-term rentals may be exacerbating housing shortages and driving up the cost of housing in our communities," the senator said in a letter to FTC Chairwoman Elizabeth Ramirez. Now, of course, Edith Ramirez, excuse me. Of course, that one of like, and I could definitely see people potentially only renting short-term properties and not renting long-term definitely takes those homes out of the long-term rental. So there's that aspect of it. Anyway, one of the things that's problematic with this space and is the lack of regulatory rules around it. When an individual who's not really running a business, is just renting their apartment out, opens up their apartment for potential people, and they say, "Want to stay here?" And people say, "I want to stay here." And then the person that's renting it goes, "Oh, but you're black, so no, you can't stay here." There's serious problems in that. And actually, that's happening on Airbnb all the time. People that of color find that the best way to rent the place is to make sure their picture is not of them or doesn't represent their skin tone or whatever it is that might be, might be something that somebody's going to say no to. And so they change their names on them and they do all these things. And of course, this sucks. And a fully regulated company like a hotel, there's laws around who they can serve and who they can't serve, and they basically have to serve everybody.
Right, and there's financial interests that are so large that they don't dare go after or go against the laws.
Right, and the bigotry stuff to some degree is controlled by profit.
So people exactly. Go,
nope, it's fine. And, you know, anyway, so it's definitely something that we have to look into and figure out how to achieve this. It sucks that. Is one of the motivators that I see strong reason for having some kind of some kind of training or some kind of system of regulatory.
I don't know if training is going to be the way to do it, but this whole sharing economy is a wonderful idea in that from an economist point of view, you're taking resources that aren't being used and putting them into the economy, which is going to,
The bedroom not being used for the week.
Exactly.
Why not put that in the economy? Yeah.
Or with autonomous cars, most cars sit around most of their lives in a parking lot. With all of these different ideas, you're putting something to use that is idle and out of the economy. And that's a great thing economist point of view. But, how do you regulate that? You take something that was much more centralized and you decentralize it, and all of a sudden you run into a position where you can't regulate everyone's behavior. And we're back to problems we thought we had solved a long time ago.
Yeah. I got to say, it is definitely sad. Like I've done Airbnb. Like I've ran a house for like 6 months where we rented it like as much as we possibly could through Airbnb. It was a lot of cleaning because every time someone comes out, you got to do all the laundry, you got to do the cleaning. And when it came down to it, there was a lot more process and work, but it did pull in more money than renting the place monthly.
More work, but more money. That makes sense.
Yeah. And it kind of makes sense, except that you're also servicing people that, are like in the place that I'm in, housing is really, there's not a lot, there's a lot of housing need. So having the place actually livable by, a couple, to me does seem a little more fair. But the aspect, I never even thought about the aspect of easy discrimination in that system.
So the same apartment that we rented when we were in Paris, we had to deal with some discrimination.
Oh, because you were Americans?
She asked very clearly, do you have kids? Are you bringing kids? But she knew from my wife's profile that we had kids, but we said, no, we're not bringing them. And then when we showed up, there was this uncomfortable moment where she comes running to meet us in the apartment. There was no other reason for her to meet us other than we figured later she must have wanted to make sure
this
we
kid
weren't
sneaking
kids. The kids in right. underneath the...
Little did she know you had the kids down at the corner store waiting.
Yes, they were drinking red wine in the corner shop.
Paris. Anything else we want to cover about today? Well, we're talking about diversity.
Yeah, while we're talking about diversity.
Sure.
So there was an article in the New York Times about a comment that was made by a head Facebook recruiter. And this stirred up quite a bit of talk. And
That was the thing saying it's the pipeline problem. We can't get women in tech because of the pipeline, where it means there's not a lot of people to choose to hire. That's why we don't have women hiring at Facebook. That story in the New York Times.
That is the summary of the story.
And that's a common story. I've heard that story a lot.
Yes. Now, I didn't read the story. It's behind a paywall. But I read a number of articles that discuss the whole issue. And this one... on Medium was really, really probably the best description and indictment of the Silicon Valley tech workforce interview process and related to race and other diversity issues.
Diversity hiring in general, yeah.
Diversity hiring in general. And
the title is The Big Lie, Tech Companies and Diversity Hiring.
And she walks through three main points and talking about... the different things that can contribute to a diverse workforce or not, and how the Silicon Valley companies do this. So one of the many things is hiring interns. They tend to only hire interns from a few schools that they've used for a long time. And these are not traditionally black schools in any way. These are schools where the author said, well, if I wanted to get an internship, which is essential for a lot of students to get their career started, she's going to have to go to a much larger school like Georgia Tech, where she went.
Sure.
And she did this 15 years ago and got an internship at Microsoft. Well, her kid brother's friend wanted to get an internship as well in recent year. And they weren't hired by Microsoft, but they did get an internship at Apple after they got their all of their information out into the internet for it to be found. So Apple apparently definitely goes and scrapes the web for information on possible internship candidates. And she starts outlining the actual diversity of each of these companies. So Microsoft, who would find its interns typically from the main schools, has a diversity, black workforce of 3.5% overall and 2.3% in the tech workforce. Apple, 8% overall workforce and 7% in the tech workforce. Mm-hmm. And Apple's been in the news a lot lately about their efforts. And then she goes on through a number of other companies, including Google, which has a 2% overall workforce.
Wow, that's pretty bad.
With black employees and 1% of their tech workforce. And of course, our own Miles Elam was one of those for a while. Facebook is down there at the 2% level. In fact, Twitter is as well. And they all have a very similar story. And these recruiters that work at Facebook and Twitter are the ones that are saying that, you know what, the problem isn't that we...
Wait, so to be clear, Facebook, Twitter, and Google all have a 2% overall workforce of black... Are we talking black specifically or underrepresented? Let's say, I think it's black, actually.
I believe this is black. No, this is black. Specifically about black workforce.
1% in the tech workforce. That means that there's more HR staff members or business staff members or whatever, or marketing staff members than computer programmers. That's right. The tech versus non-tech. But all of them have the same. Of course, they're all located in the same location.
Yes, which is another one of her points, which is if you want to increase your diversity, you need to look at where your office locations are.
Right.
In fact, Google used to have an office in downtown Atlanta, which they have since closed up. But of course, the largest black populations are in the American South, where Atlanta was located.
Right.
And all of these decisions...
So when they had that office, was there better diversity in the office? Or I should say, did it help the overall Google diversity plan?
Not the overall numbers of the massive corporation.
Just not enough people in that office.
But yeah, it did obviously have more black employees there. And then she goes over the whole idea of diversity training and...
Oh, that's such a good read about diversity training. Yeah.
So what's the problem with it? The idea is that the way diversity training is implemented and maybe just the fundamental idea of diversity training is actually backfiring entirely. The studies show that people are less likely... Well, first of all, after diversity training, anything that they learned is only put into practice for at most 2 days. If they went through this diversity training, it's very likely that they got a lot of negative messages about
they
diversity.
They resent the training.
And they resent the training.
Well, here's
the
thing.
And it backfires. And there's less diversity in the company afterwards.
But additionally, like having a diversity training where the staff is still not diverse, it feels like it's a waste of time. In some ways it is, because it's not actually solving the problem.
Right.
Right. So it's a thing that everyone knows isn't really solving the problem. And it's taking time, so people resent it. But the other thing is, the company can say on the bottom line, oh, we spend this much money on diversity training, therefore we're good. Well, no, because your company's not diverse.
If your two main pillars about diversity are diversity training and your hiring, and you're spending more of your effort on diversity training, which is backfiring and creating this bad will, it's allowing you to say that you're doing what you need to do and you're not doing it at all.
I've been sensitive about this topic for quite a while. And one of the things I was thinking about, and it kind of makes sense to me, but it's a little odd. There's a strong argument to say that diversity actually produces a better workforce, a better product, a better everything, because diverse thought allows you for potentially better, smarter decisions, right? If you and I are the ones that are always planning some product and somebody comes in and has a different perspective than us, the product's going to get better, right? Even if we all argue and we come up with something that maybe was mostly you and I coming up, we would have come up by ourselves, whatever addition they add to it is going to be different than what we can bring to it because of the diversity, right?
Absolutely.
So therefore, better product with more diverse. And that's kind of what the studies say, right? So it's actually better practice for a company to have a diverse populace. And it's really hard to hire women. The companies say, because of the pipeline, the person that wrote this article is saying it's not actually the pipeline necessarily, it's how you actually do it and what work you do. It's going to be hard, but it's not really the pipeline necessarily. You could do it. But what you could also just do is if you were an individual company and you wanted to have, let's say, more women represented in the tech fields, just double the salary of women doing those jobs. You will get more women there because all the women from other companies will join you for your workforce. You'll have a more diverse population and therefore a better product, and you'll win on the diversity side. Like, that's the way to do it. Just to increase the rare, you know, looking for the rare people in the field, you just spend more money
right,
on them.
Right.
And I think it's kind of a cool idea.
And if your argument is simply it's going to make a better product, then it's worth it, right?
Well, maybe not double the salary, but, you know, 20% increase. Sure. And of course, we all know that women actually get less money per dollar than men.
So what you're saying is it's really a 50% increase.
God, no, I'm saying definitely, yeah, definitely do it much more and pull people in. I don't know if that would really work, but it is true that all these tech companies are in Silicon Valley, and it's really, really white in Silicon Valley, right?
Well, the problem
so
is
it does make sense that the pool that they generally going to get are just going to be kind of what's already there.
Well, and if they had a diverse population within the company, they would actually look in more diverse places, right?
Possibly,
Of the problem is the fact that they're using the same techniques in the same places that they're looking.
They're like, hey, where are good places we should look for people? Well, I'm from here too. It's like, it's at the end of a meeting, when you have like a meeting you're trying to do regularly with people, and the end of the meeting, everyone's at the meeting going, okay, well, not everybody's here, but when's the next date we should do this meeting? Well, when you pick that date in that time, you will only get those people. Like, you're not going to, you've got to change that pattern. Anyway.
Anyways, there's one part here I do want to read because it makes a point better than I can just trying to discuss it. So she goes on about one of the open secrets working in technology is that technical interviews are completely worthless as a predictor about whether someone's a good hire or not.
It's a fundamental part of her whole process, whole discussion.
Yeah.
Because what people will inevitably say is, well, we want to hire really good people. We want to hire diverse people, but...
So there was a study at Google in their hiring practices, and this is the quote from a Google resource manager. Years ago, we did a study to determine whether anyone at Google is particularly good at hiring. We looked at tens of thousands of interviews and everyone who had done the interviews and what they scored the candidate and how that person ultimately performed their job. We found zero relationship. It's a complete random mess, except for one guy who was highly predictive because he only interviewed people for a very specialized area where he happened to be the world's leading expert. Mm-hmm. So here's one bit of evidence that the interview process is flawed and that it doesn't really get to what a good candidate is, what a good hire is.
And as a person that sat on committees for hiring people in this field at, you know, Netflix, one of the big, you know, tech companies that hires people, I fully believe that because I've gone through and interviewed people and I go, well, they were good. I don't know. And that's all it's based off of, right?
Like, and what have you
if
heard?
They, I mean, if they mess up, right? If they really don't know something, then clearly. But you know, it's mostly is if they don't know an answer, they say they do, you then say, oh, what about this problem? And they're closed-minded to that problem. Like they go, nope.
Right, because you want to know how they think.
Right, but if then they go, oh, I see what you're saying, and change their mind, they just won. Even if they didn't even know the product. Like, those qualities are so much more important working on a team. But in any case, most everybody, they've gotten to the point where we actually are going to interview them and look through them technically. They're capable, and then it's just about like whether they're a fit. And that whether they're a fit kind of means whether they're, you know, matching the people that already work there. Like
That's not diversity hiring. That's not helping your team.
No.
So I've heard you say this before when you were involved in searching for women candidates, mm-hmm, and other diverse candidates. What is the one worry that somebody might have in hiring someone?
This is what I was queuing up. Like what the Facebook article story was, you know, we want to hire women in the field and it's really important, but the pipeline, meaning the people coming up are not, there's not enough women, and we can't ever, or they say something like, we can't ever lower the bar, right? Lower the bar is the term they use, which of course is ridiculous. No one's ever suggesting that, really.
Right. No one's suggesting that. You want good candidates. You just want good candidates that happen to have a diverse background.
If Google says that you can't really know if someone's going to be good at the job or not, what's the bar?
Exactly. And that is the indictment that I thought was so incredible about this article, is that it brings it right back around to why, what are we doing in this process?
Yeah.
If you can't figure out where that bar is, why are you blocking diverse candidates from being a part of it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. I mean, I got to say, I'm always surprised by the people that start working. Cause, you know, I've been working 2.5 years or so at Netflix and we hire a lot of engineers and the whole floor is a lot of engineers and designers too. And I've phone screened people and I've interviewed people and we talk about who we've might hire, and then people start, and normally they're just awesome. But I don't know. Like, I remember this time we had this big debate whether this one person was going to get a thumbs up or thumbs down. Lots of debate about it. And they came in, and they're still working there, and they've been awesome. And any concern there might have been at some point in that process was clearly not founded, right? Because they're great.
And
but there was, but there was debate.
And there was debate. And, yeah. And their spelling was bad, but they overcame that.
No, that was my problem. It's like the whole thing, all the email we're getting lately is about, wait, you could be a programmer and spell? I can't spell bad? I can't spell well? Or speak bad? Let's wrap this one up. It's been an hour, man.
Yeah, that was fun.
That was a lot of fun. Thank you, Brian, for doing this.
We should come to Vegas more often.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission in GeekSpeak is Creative Commons. Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you'd like them. Just let them know we made it. Thanks to our intern, Chandler, and our giant list of patrons who the first of the month I will definitely thank individually. I want to thank Greg Merkley, who provided this week's episode title, which is Pokemon Drives Terror App to Airbnb. Also, I want to thank Michael Newman of Pet Star Music for our theme song, and thank you all for being here for episode 29 of our 16th season. Brian, we got a couple stories we didn't get to. So first of all, thanks for doing GeekSpeak with me. But the one story that we didn't get to that's on your list, I don't know if you want to cover
it. Oh, this is a quickie.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah. So you know what ransomware is, right?
I do know what ransomware is.
How long has it been around now? 2-3 years?
Yeah, I mean, it's been popular for that long.
Popular.
We've been talking about it for that long. It might be that it's came around a lot earlier. But ransomware, very simply, people get on your computer, and instead of taking their files away and charging you for them, they just encrypt the files, they keep the key, and then you basically have to pay money to get the key back or your files are not recoverable. This is a big reason to have a backup, a backup that has multiple stage backups, especially for your photos. Okay, yes, go on. That's ransomware.
Exactly. So the amazing thing about ransomware that I always thought was amazing is that all the stories seem to say that if you didn't have a backup and you actually had to pay the ransomer for your files, that they, most cases, were giving out keys. In fact, it seemed to be a full-on business that had developed in the black market of the internet.
If you want your ransoming to succeed and grow, you better do it right.
So, well, now somebody's decided to go and spoil that because they've released a ransomware that has no intention of giving you anything back. In fact, all it does is just delete files willy-nilly left and right. In fact, it will keep deleting things on Windows to make it so that you can't use your system restores use your shadow copies.
That's just bad virus.
Just a plain bad virus.
Yeah.
And yet it's still called ransomware because it puts up a message saying, please give us money. And they will accept the money. And
not do anything.
And not do anything.
So this is not really ransomware.
It's ransom. It's giving you a ransom. It just won't give you the prisoner back.
But you have a great title here. Is it ZDNet's article title?
Yeah, this is ZDNet's.
What do they call it?
RAM scan.
RAN scam.
RAN scam.
RAN scamware. Awesome. Okay, I alluded earlier that I've been doing a lot of that we're going to talk about software stuff and Pokemon Go. So
what?
Yeah. I did allude to it. You just weren't listening. So Pokemon has been very popular, but it is kind of buggy. One bug is that their servers keep on crashing because they start up new countries and not ready for it. Whatever.
Minor bug.
Not a big deal. I mean, gosh, imagine if like Netflix was crashing like that, people would be so furious.
I heard there's a site that tells you whether Pokemon's up or down, and that site was going down.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about massive traffic. I mean, I remember I was talking with Maggie about this, my wife, and she's pretty technically savvy, right? And she's like, well, they're just going to spend a lot of money to fix this problem. And I go, that's great. And they have a lot of money. That's not a problem. But you can't actually fix scaling issues post by adding money. You have to design it correctly in the beginning.
You mean there's no way to test with 500 million people?
No. There's ways of testing this. There's definitely methodologies you can use that will scale correctly. But if you start early without this done correctly, you are not going to succeed at scale. Like, it's one of those core problems. If you're like, well, I just have my database, and if we have more, we'll just have more databases, and how do you do reads across multiple databases with different data sets, and how do you sync them? Like, these problems definitely exist. There's systems in place. Cassandra solves that problem I just kind of talked about. But in general, you have to do it correctly early to scale correctly. So right now, there are engineers that are just freaking out trying to get this to work. And they're regionizing traffic and they're doing a whole bunch of things. Luckily, they have a mostly region-based read-write. I was wondering if my data was going to be synced when I transferred my location from Silicon Valley area to Nevada.
Which data? Your
my
score?
Account. Or your just account? My account stuff. Yeah. Like when you're using your your Pokemon thing, you're collecting items and they're on your phone, but they of course have to sync to the server. And definitely that syncing is the truth, if you will, because this other bug that occurs, which causes a crash, happens right after you've collected a Pokemon sometimes. And afterwards, when you restart the app, you do have that Pokemon in your inventory most of the time. And that means that most likely they're doing a sync to the server successfully, but they're not actually doing the UI update. So the bug is this, Brian. I'm going to describe this bug because I ran into the same thing at work, and I think it's the same bug.
Oh, you actually run into the bug yourself in the code?
Yes. So I've been doing this thing called Word Party, the Jim Henson Show. And in it, as you, in the interactive moments of the show, it stops and there's like playing cards displayed on the screen. They animate in and you tap them and they flip over and they teach you a word. Wallaby, I've got fuzzy ears and fuzzy feet. Okay. And then after that voiceover happens of the little kid talking about what a wallaby is, the card then animates off the screen. And at that point, after it's animated off the screen, all the other cards reshuffle and then you can tap one again. That's the kind of methodology that I implemented. And, the way that this all works is by callbacks. And can you describe what a callback is?
Asynchronous programming.
Perfect. Okay, we're done. No.
So it's like you give a command and you send it off into the world and it does something. But you also send with that command a little function, a little piece of code that will be run at the end of that, of the first commands.
Perfect. That was a perfect explanation. Perfect.
Yes.
So the example we'll do is I tap the card and the card has to animate over, flip over. So on user tap, we animate the card to flip over. Well, the flipping over takes however long it takes. So the animation that I created that does the multiple steps to flip in 3D space and all of that, it accepts that command flip over, accepts a callback. And that callback is a method that then plays an audio file. Make sense? So you click it, and when it's finished flipping over, the animation, whatever duration it happens and all that, depending on your computer and all that, flips over, then it plays the audio file. Wallaby! Okay. When Wallaby finishes playing, I want the card now to animate off. So the audio track now also has a callback completion where it will then run a piece of code. And that piece of code is to start another animation. So it's animation, audio file, animation, and then another animation.
So as long as each one of these completes, it calls the callback and it goes to the next one.
That's right. We had another bug in our the background audio task management system where we were calling kind of a no-op code block as fast as the machine could possibly call it. So though it was no-op, doesn't really affect a lot except for it affected processor time. You got a lot of cycles on the processor. So you'd see on the iPad, one of the processors would ping. When this happened, so what was happening is those audio completion blocks weren't happening. So you tap the card, it would animate over, and it would never say Wallaby. And it would never do anything else.
But the processor's working hard.
Well, so we were solving problems. That would only happen every once in a while. That was solving problems. We found this other problem about the processor, so we stopped doing the processor. Now this audio flipping thing almost never happened. So there's a timing issue where in certain situations, the post-audio thing does not run. The completion block for the audio or the audio file doesn't play and the completion block doesn't run. It just stops. And what that looks like is the card flips over. Well, when the card flips over like this, you can't do anything else because the card needs to animate off before it reshuffle to allow the other cards to be tapped. Like they're all connected. So I made sure that you can always close this thing. And the bug though, once we fix that other pigging processor thing bug, that bug just is rare. Like we've run it hundreds of times. I actually automated a system that would run this whole, I automated this whole thing. And I ran it on an iPad for 24 hours, came back, no problem. And I ran like multiple copies of them, like a lot, hundreds of them a minute kind of thing. No problems. So it's some kind of timing problem with animation callbacks affecting other, and I can't figure it out exactly. And it's been frustrating. So I put logging around to hopefully detect it. And keep in mind, I know what I'm doing, so I have other methodologies for checking if the audio file exists and whether the audio file is playable. Like I'm checking all those things.
Yes, he's not telling you everything he's doing.
No, it is more. Okay, so I'm with my family. We're playing Pokemon, And at one point, you throw these little balls at the Pokemon creatures, the little creatures. And when you hit them correctly, the ball opens up and you grab this creature and suck it into the ball. And then the ball, the next screen is the ball landing on the virtual grass, and it kind of hops and it plays an audio and it goes, and then it makes a chime sound. And after the chime sound, it gets a little text field shows up that says, great job or congratulations. And then you move on. Well, with this bug in Pokemon Go, the thing animates for a second, the audio doesn't play, and nothing happens. It just sits there. And I look at this, and it happens once. I'm like, wow, that was weird. And I restarted the app. And then it happened to my son, and then it happened to me. And I'm like, oh my God, this is the same iOS bug. There's this very subtle bug in iOS that has to do with animations and audio callbacks and some problem emerging there. I think, because I'm seeing it, and it's also in the Pokemon game.
But these are two different systems. You've got
You've
got the 2D cards being animated on your app, and you've got 3D. Why can't I remember the API for 3D?
Probably in this, though, in this situation, that image is probably an image. It is probably not a 3D rendered thing.
Oh, okay. So
yeah,
that's
yeah, they do move to, okay. Yeah. And additionally, I am animating UI views, and
which are probably 3D UI layers.
And I do animate in a flip 3 dimensions, but that's beside the point. What you're talking about is that the actual game, there are, I don't know. I think that's probably not 3D really. Maybe. There's a little bit of depth perspective there. You got to toss.
I've only seen the still images.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's big about it is that it's locking the image to the camera, so it reads the camera data when you have that feature on, and you lock the item to the room. So as you move, the item sits in one place, which is kind of cool if it's like on the ground. Additionally, if you're playing this game, make sure to turn that off because that burns through a battery really fast. You can flip it off, so it's just a plain field. Anyway, I thought it was really cool to see a potential same bug. Now, my friend is like, you've got to report this to Apple. But reporting a bug you can't reproduce is like complaining. You know, it just doesn't, it's not the same.
Yeah, well, no, but there's probably 100 other submissions of the bug, and you just need to add your voice to
it. What I need to do is go through radar and actually see if I can find this bug.
You can't go through other people's radars.
Oh, you can't you?
No. No, you're locked out of that. You can go through Open Radar. Do you submit through Open Radar?
I've never even heard of Open Radar.
Oh, come on. You got to be a good part of the community.
See, I'm not a single individual developer, right? I'm working on a team like 15 other iOS developers. So we just all talk amongst each other.
No. So Apple has its radar system that you can submit bugs through. In fact, I think that's the same system that the public can submit bugs through when they have them in beta OSs and things like that. And that goes into the black hole that is Apple. And it's important to do this.
That's just mean, dude.
No.
I was like talking that way at a meeting, meetup somewhere. And I was like chatting, like, oh, you know, and Apple just doesn't really pay attention to this problem with this view.
I didn't say they didn't pay attention. No, I was saying this. I'm just saying you never see it come out of the black hole.
I was complaining to this, and this guy's like, yeah, that's what I was programming at when I was working at Apple, and we totally care. I'm like, I'm sorry if it's so bad.
Yes. Your problem is somebody's baby. No, but it's important. So there's another system called Open Radar. So you can also put it in there. And that way it's searchable by other developers. And in fact, one of my Open Radars got put on somebody's Twitter and put out there, and other people going, yeah, I've seen that. In fact, it's bigger than just what you said. It's over here too.
Yeah.
No, it's good to do.
I mean, I've definitely filed when I can replicate a bug, I've filed it, and I've actually gotten great like feedback from Apple on these problems. Actually, not really Apple. It was really the what's the Safari web engine WebKit?
WebKit, yeah.
It's actually an open source. Apple engineers work on it, but it's actually an open source project as well. In any case, those are the bugs that I used to find in CSS obscurities. When I did a lot of that stuff.
So wait, you haven't submitted a bug since you've been working on the iOS SDK?
No.
Wow. Nice and stable platform there.
That's not true at all, Brian.
No, it's not at all.
It's just that I've got to get things done. And if I can make it work around, like the thing is when you file a bug.
No, that is not the right way to do it.
Wait a second. If I've got a product I have to ship, okay?
Yes. You do the workaround, then you go back.
No. Wait a second. If I have to solve a problem and I can solve that problem, if I run into an obstacle, taking the extra time to make sure that Apple's aware of that obstacle is not productive for me to get my job done, because Apple might fix that or they might not. It's a black box. But also, when they finally fix it on some other later date, they won't necessarily backport it to iOS 8. it might still be a bug in iOS forever. So if I can't solve it, then what's the? It doesn't help me.
Well, what happens when you run into that same bug 2 years later and they still haven't fixed it?
I already have the fix, man. I already solved it once.
It's not a fix. It's a workaround. That's not a fix.
Okay, wait a second.
Do you want an SDK that's entirely filled with workarounds?
We already have that. No, I'm not saying that. Wait a second. When we talk about a workaround, here's an example of what I consider a kind of UI bug. If you open an XIB file, a ZIB or whatever you want to call it, an interface builder file.
Yes.
And you don't do anything to it. And it modifies that a change has happened to the file. And then you have to go into source management software, get control, you know, get to do it, check out of that file again because you know you didn't touch it. That's a bug. Am I going to report that to them? No. They're not going to fix that. To them, it's a feature because they're updating the zip because now it's a new version of the blah, blah, blah. It doesn't matter. I don't want to change that file. I don't want to commit that. I'm not doing that. And yet it wants to do it for me.
You had to go right there.
Oh, yeah.
I can't defend that.
I know you can't. But that's because it's interface builder.
But if an individual developer that makes one app on the App Store can submit bugs throughout the year, you at Megacorp Netflix with a team of how many can find the time to at least submit one or for a workaround? Okay,
look, if I got a bug, okay, we get bugs. On the Netflix app has bugs, right?
Yeah.
So bugs.
Software has bugs.
Software has bugs. That's the definition of software. Machine, complicated machine instructions that's buggy.
If you want software that doesn't have bugs, you won't want to pay for it.
Don't turn it on. When we get a bug, if it's like, oh, you know, I got logged out. What? How am I going to solve that? I can't solve that, right?
Right.
So if you say, oh, I got logged out and I was in a, I have a, you know, I signed up in France, but I'm in Belgium.
If you have something reproducible.
And when I was watching this show, still could be problematic, right? But then if they also give me their email address and give me permission to look at their logs, now we're getting to a point where like, I might be able to figure that out. If I say to Apple, hey, by the way, sometimes when you play an audio file after an animation completion block, the audio file never plays. Good luck with that. They're not going to know what they can't do anything about that. They can't. It doesn't help them.
The best that can happen is that there's
another exact same problem or submission, and it's another example of that. And to some degree, I feel like responsibility because I represent a larger company, in the sense that if you know I as a Netflix employee is saying we have this bug, and somebody else has been saying it too, then Apple might pay more attention to it. That's the only credence. But I'd love to already see the description of the bug. It'd be great if I could actually see the original post. Anyway.
Yes. Well, no, you do need something reproducible.
Do you know the workaround I was thinking about for like really solving this? I have a really bad workaround that's not a long-term solution. And that is that I make sure the close button's always there. I know that's weak. The second one that I'm thinking of doing is
a timer.
Yes.
Oh, no.
Yes.
No.
Well, the reason that one's nice is that I can actually log that it happened and I can give stats. So if I can say, you know, even if it's a pretty complicated problem, I can give source code samples to Apple and say, hey, by the way, this happens one in every 10,000 times or one in every 1,000 times. So if I put logging around, I actually detect it. I can actually tell exactly how frequent it is.
So you
that would help them.
You can't give a reproducible example, but at least you can give them stats of how bad their code is working.
No, I would give them the full complexity of the app. I would go ahead and give them that controller and just be like, this is the controller that's doing it. Here you go. this is source code owned by Apple, by Netflix, not you guys. And when we run this in the wild on devices, this is how much it happens. That would be helpful. Maybe I'll do that.
I bet you can find a few minutes to try to do that.
I don't know if that's true.
But you sound like you're building a system like that back in the days where I had these cobbled together systems that I don't even know how they ever
worked.
Anytime
you have a timer that's going to help you with a problem, you're doing it wrong.
So in the code, you just say, I'm doing it wrong. Yes, I know.
Oh, no, definitely comment on doing it wrong. And the pull requests, I'd go over with coffee first. Be like, hey, guys.
Better than mine.
So here's the reason for this. And then I'll have the whole discussion I just had with you. And I'm like, why don't you file the Jira? Well, because.
Which is why the workaround is so much of a pain.
This is why I'm never going to do this. I'm just going to solve the problem for myself, make sure the customers aren't suffering, and move on.
Okay. Well, may we all deal with only bugs that we've created so we can fix them.
The problem is all the bugs that I run into are ones that some other guy made. Some guy named Lyle like 2 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Those bugs.
Yes, and the program you were a year ago is the worst program ever.
It seems to always be the case. I was looking at some code today on the plane. And I looked at it, I was like, this isn't mine. I didn't write this. I was sure I didn't write it. But so it was in a file that I created, and it was completely my project and my baby. It was actually the same file that I'm talking about. It was the controller that manages these cards, right? And I'm like, well, it has to be me that wrote it. Because this is the, like, I haven't done any pull requests around this. I know this is mine. But I don't remember this writing this. And I don't know why this is here. And I'm like, well, I kind of know why it's here, but I don't think it's working the way it should be working. Like, it's here for a purpose that's not really true because it doesn't really do that. And I went through this whole process in my mind, and then I finally did a git blame.
Yes.
Yeah, it's me. It was me 3 months ago.
And the reason why it took you so long to do that is because you knew in the heart of hearts.
I knew it was me the whole time. Oh, God. I should go find out if that code ever runs. Software's complex.
Yeah, tell me about it.
So we're in Vegas and stuff, but we haven't talked about Vegas. Anything you want to say about Vegas?
So the first thing I noticed, I haven't been in Vegas in about 10, maybe 12 years. First thing I notice is I walk into the Cosmopolitan lobby, and all the game machines, they're all video now. They're all completely electronic video games, except for, you know, there's a couple ones that have some moving parts, but at least 90% of them are.
The thing that I'm so frustrated with is all those things have the, what's the big arm called?
Lever arm.
No, it's got a great name. When I banned it. No, it's got a name. I'll look it up. But they all have those. They also have a button on them. You don't need to pull it. It just hits a little toggle switch inside. It's just so aggravating. It doesn't like make a spring move or anything.
Ugh. But the whole idea that the entire system is electronically controlled, how in the world can any sort of gaming regulation be able to know that code running there is at all fair and not gamed in any way?
And doesn't have a bug they have to file with the radar.
Yeah, what happens when the animation stops on those?
Wait, so you're saying is the software is probably relatively complex and they're supposed to regulate it. It used to be they could like count the amount of teeth on a dial and go, oh yeah, the probability of this is that.
Right. There was some hope of looking inside of a mechanical machine and finding that, oh yes, obviously this one is being gamed. But with software, there's no hope of them sitting down and decompiling everything or even looking through the source code. How are they going to provably determine that there's no system in there that's trying to thwart the official rules?
They're not going to be able to check that. That's why electronic voting is so problematic. It's really hard to do that. I think the best way to do it would be like, look how much money was put in and look how much money went out. And that would be the way. Just from statistics, you know how much it pays.
Yeah. So casinos are only allowed to make a certain amount of profit and that's it?
No. Well, no, all the slot machines have a legal percentage, and they have to publish what the percentage is. Do you know that?
Oh yeah, I had heard that.
Yeah, the win-loss percentage, it was like 97%.
Right, those are the regulations house. I'm referring
yeah.
to.
Yeah, totally. So absolutely, you know, you've got to have that in place, and then you've got to make sure that you're following those rules. So you just make sure you look at the money that comes in, the money goes out, and it should be that percentage. That's it.
Can you go ask them for the percentage of this machine?
Yeah, I think you can.
Can you actually say, when was the last time this machine paid out?
Oh, I think you can.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like a cheat.
See, if I'd done good research, we would have known that tonight for recording. Would have gone in there and gotten kicked out, probably.
I don't think I've ever paid money for any gambling.
Never?
Well, not. No. Gentlemen's bets.
Oh my God, they all have. So the candle is the light on top of the machine. It flashes to alert the operator that change is needed. The carousel refers to the grouping of slot machines. So a whole bunch of slot machines are connected together and now networked. Like those video slot machines are actually networked together. The credit meter, the coin hopper, the drop bucket, the EGM, electronic gaming machine. Oh, that's the actual brain in the box. The free spin button.
Which is the replacement for the arm?
Yeah, free spin is a term. No, it's when you get to play again. Such a stupid idea. Let me read it to you. Free spin is a term used in video slots and online slot games to specify that a spin will be completed without a charge on the same wager. Free spins can get triggered by a number of things. Each game uses a different method. Usually landing a number of special symbols or reels is required to activate the free spin bonus round. Sorry. I just love the idea that, well, you lost, but you get a free spin. It's like you're just delaying the gratification.
Oh. What's it called? A Skinner box when you just have that little button to push to get your fix?
I'll get there.
Fix.
Low level, meal book, hopper fill slip, optimal play, pay line, roll up, short pay, scatter symbol. Man, where's the name of the freaking bar thing? Mobile, they don't say the name of the.
That's because it's so obvious.
Everybody knows what it is.
Right. Okay.
We're done?
I'm done with Vegas.
The minimum theoretical payout percentage varies among jurisdictions. Slot machines are typically programmed to pay out as winnings 82% to 98% of the money that is wagered by players. This is known as the theoretical payout percentage, or RTP, return to player. The minimum theoretical payout, blah, 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 different regions and all that. The minimum payout in Nevada is 75%.
Ooh,
that's bad. In New Jersey, it's 83%, and Mississippi, it's 80%. The winning patterns of slot machines, the amounts, the pay, and the frequencies of those payouts are carefully selected to yield a certain fraction of the money paid to the house. The operator of the slot machine, while returning the rest to the players during the play. Yeah. Anyway.
The point of the matter is you're not going to win.
It's just a money-stealing machine. Vegas is just... I knew that when you and I found out that we were both going to Vegas at the same time, I was like, yeah, we're going to just rag on it the entire time. We had good food today.
We had good food, and there's thousands of people out there that seem to be having a good time, or at least they seem to think they're
having a
good time.
There is a lot of drunk people out there enjoying themselves. Absolutely.
Okay.
To Vegas. And to sleeping. Thanks, Brian, for doing the show with me. It was fun.
Which day did we do this on? I think we slipped into another day, didn't we?
That's all right. We started on Monday. It's now Tuesday, 12:30. Oh, man. And this is, of course, Wednesday's show, the 20th of July.
A trans-temporal geek speak.
Whoa, nice words late at night. Good night.
Good night.